Starting Overdrive. Real stories of starting over with Red Seaton.
Hey everyone, welcome to Starting Overdrive, where you'll hear real stories of starting over from real people of all walks of life. I'm your host, Reg Seaton. Welcome to part two of the Starting Overdrive Turning Point series called The Day I Woke Up from a Coma. In this new segment of the podcast called Turning Points, I focus on significant, life-changing events directly connected to the process of starting over. Events, or turning points, that alter who we are, force us to change direction in life, and let go of everything we once knew. This segment is an exploration into life-defining, irreversible turning points that rock us to the very core of our being and force us to accept change, whether we like it or not. It's through these irreversible turning points that we truly learn who we are on the deepest level, what we can handle in life, the true power of the human spirit, and who we were meant to become. On many levels, who we thought we were before these major life-changing events was only preparing us for who we're supposed to be after the turning point. The following story is the most important irreversible turning point that changed my life forever. It's the day I woke up from a coma. This episode is a continuation of part one, in which I detailed the night that changed my life forever, when, in 1985, I was hit by a car while walking home with friends and left clinging to life on the side of the Bedford Highway in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I grew up. After being rushed to the hospital in an ambulance and into surgery to save my life, as my father watched his son disappear into the operating room from the hallway, this is where the second part of my life turning points begins. In fact, this story begins a few days after the night that changed my life forever in the previous story. This story details the aftermath of an accident with graphic words that may produce traumatic imagery and be too much for the sensitive listener. Listener discretion is advised. It was black, pitch black, darkness everywhere. I was awake, but in my own reality. My own awareness that I was not awake. It was as if I was present and conscious in my own dream. I was somewhere, but I didn't know where. It felt like I was sleeping, but also awake in my own consciousness. I was trapped in the dark, with no way out. The strange thing was, it was okay. Wherever I was, it was peaceful and calm. It was as if I was living and existing in the presence of the moment. Time was irrelevant. I was the presence, and I was the moment at the same time. The only thing I was conscious of was my awareness, a recognition of my own awareness in a dark, peaceful stillness. I was alive, somewhere. I didn't need to know where because it didn't matter. All that mattered was the moment, the now, and my awareness of the moment. Within the darkness, the pitch black, everything was unknown yet comforting and familiar. It was as if I already knew where I was, a deep feeling of knowing and understanding where I was beyond words, which made any questions about where I was irrelevant. I didn't need to know, because where I was in the unknown was everything I was experiencing in the moment. And like I mentioned, the only thing that mattered was the moment. I wasn't afraid. There was no fear. There was nothing to fear. In place of fear was a calm curiosity, a curiosity from a place of observation. I was an observer of my experience in the moment, watching the darkness, curious about what was unfolding in real time and what would happen next. I was in a coma and had been for several days up until this point. For those of you listening who haven't heard the first part in this series, the year was 1985. A few days earlier, on May 18, 1985, late at night, I had been hit by a car, struck from behind on the Bedford Highway in Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, while walking home late at night with three friends. It was a hit-and-run accident in which the driver fled the scene. According to paramedics, doctors, and those with me that night when I was hit by the car, I flew backward over the hood, cracking my head on the windshield, and the car's momentum propelled me forward through the air, 40 feet, where I narrowly missed a wooden lamppost by inches, landing hard on the ground, on the side of my head with a loud crack, skidding on the ground like a lifeless mannequin, coming to a stop where I was left clinging to life as my three stunned and terrified friends scrambled for help. To this day, I still don't know who called the ambulance. It was late at night, after midnight, and my three friends were frantic and trying to get help, banging on doors, yelling for someone, anyone, to wake up and call for an ambulance. It was a time prior to cell phones and the internet, so you were more dependent on others who had landline phones. But someone did make that call, and I'm eternally grateful to whoever it was that did. The ambulance was on the scene within minutes, and I was rushed to the hospital. At the end of part one of this Turning Point series in the previous episode, I was rushed into surgery immediately, with my father already at the hospital, having watched me thrash around on the stretcher, covered head to toe in blood, as they rushed me down the hall. Like the moments leading up to my accident, I have no recollection or memory of arriving at the hospital. It was too much trauma for my brain to handle. Still to this day, I only remember the last 30 to 45 seconds prior to being hit by the car. That's when everything went black. They say you're not supposed to remember being in a coma. I don't know where I first heard that or who said it, but it's always stuck with me because I do remember being in a coma. The experience is as real to me and still as vivid today as it was back then. Even now to this day, so many years later, a Google search of, in quotes, not supposed to remember being in a coma, produces a variety of interesting results, ranging from such mental experiences as dreams and hallucinations to vivid events, imagery, and happenings around a person while in a coma. To me, my coma experience was very real, with imagery, events, and experiences I remember today like it was just yesterday. For those who have been in a coma, each person's experience is different. The interesting thing and comforting thing about my coma is that I can still tap into that state today on a spiritual level. Some people may call it a state of enlightenment, a peaceful stillness of oneness, and they may access that state through things like meditation. The only way I can describe it is, once you experience this state, you can always experience it. It never leaves you. For me, the state of being in a coma is an extension of who I am. There's no separation. Because of my accident, I accessed a state of being or existing that I otherwise wouldn't have accessed had it not been for that traumatic event. There's a peaceful stillness that I have inside of me that many people can't understand. I don't have a fear of the unknown. I've already been to the unknown inside myself on a completely different level where fear is irrelevant. I often say today that it doesn't make sense for me to fear the unknown because I'd only be fearing myself or the unknown territory within myself, which I've already experienced, and there was nothing to fear. Being in a coma, I had no concept of time or knowledge of what happened to me. I had no concept of days or minutes. Everything was just one state. Like I mentioned earlier, all that mattered was the moment, and that moment had no beginning or end. It just was. All that mattered was the now of experience, the state of experiencing. It was very much like I was sleeping, but conscious in my state of unconsciousness, awake in a state of unconscious awareness. It was like I knew I was asleep, but I had no burning desire to wake up either. I was content in the moment as a curious observer. And I also knew that I couldn't move, but physical movement in that state of coma was also irrelevant. I was trapped in the dark with no way out, but at the same time, I wasn't trying to escape. There was nothing to fear or flee. Now, I have to say, my memory of being in a coma wasn't a constant state of awareness either. It wasn't like I was awake or consciously aware for 8 to 12 hours per day like we all experience in life. The unconscious awareness came in waves. When they rushed me into surgery, a lot had to be done from head to toe to save my life. My cheekbone was fractured and out of place. My skull was fractured. My jaw was dislocated. my eye socket was damaged. But more importantly, my brain was so severely injured, wounded, traumatized, and distressed that it was extremely swollen, life-threateningly swollen. There was only so much doctors could do because my brain was so swollen. I went into a coma, and all anyone could do was wait. Wait for the swelling to subside and to see what permanent damage was done to my brain. Like I mentioned in part one, the previous episode, my parents were going through a nasty, bitter divorce. I was losing my family at the exact same time. I was knee-deep in the process of starting over without my family unit when I was hit by a car. I can't imagine how difficult my accident was for them to deal with, on top of dealing with the end of their relationship. They were forced to come together in a way no one could have imagined. After my surgery, when I was first in a coma, doctors told my parents that there was a 90% likelihood that I wouldn't wake up, 10% chance that I would, but they couldn't say for certain. The only thing anyone could do was wait. Although time was irrelevant to me in a coma, time was everything to my family and loved ones. Over the next 24 to 48 hours, my condition started to improve slightly. Doctors revised their percentages, saying that there was now a 75 to 80% chance that I wouldn't wake up. Maybe a 20 to 25% chance that I would. But they stressed that if I did wake up from a coma, I'd come out of it with severe brain damage. They told my parents to prepare for the worst, but the best case would also be permanent brain damage. As I mentioned just a few minutes ago, my unconscious awareness in a coma came in waves. I can't explain how it worked. I can only go by my memories. And many of those memories in a coma were linked to auditory events and happenings around me. Obviously, I was in the hospital. I didn't know that I was in the hospital. I just knew that I was somewhere dark, and I could hear things around me. I could sense that I was in a room, but I couldn't see anyone. I could only hear the comings and goings of people around me. I knew there were people in the room, but I couldn't tell who they were, and I couldn't interact with anyone. But I had no need or desire to speak. I was content to listen. In many ways, it was like a puzzle or a game, trying to figure out what was taking place around me. And like I said, my state of unconscious awareness came in waves. Although I was content and at peace in the moment, I do remember the first time being bothered by the sounds. Wherever I was, whatever room that I was in, I could hear a woman screaming throughout the day. Her voice was loud and direct, frantic, desperate, and determined. To this day, if I close my eyes, I can still hear the shrill of this woman's voice. She was screaming, "John Hugh, wake up! Wake up, John Hugh! For God's sake, wake up, you son of a bitch! I'm going to scream all day if I have to! Wake up, goddammit!" The screaming continued for what seemed like an eternity. So much so that even in a coma, I remember thinking to myself, "Oh my God, woman, just shut up for a few minutes." And I also remember wondering why, whoever she was screaming at, wouldn't wake up. I mean, there was no way anyone could stay asleep with her yelling at you. I couldn't figure out why that person wasn't waking up. After a while, I also rooted for John Hugh to wake up, just so she'd stop screaming. Even in a coma, I could tell she was screaming at someone, and for them to wake up. As it turned out, and as I found out later, John Hugh was her husband, who was involved in a bad car accident on the way to visit their son, who was in the hospital for routine surgery. He was also in a coma in the intensive care unit in the bed beside me. His wife, her name was Marilyn, would visit day and night, pleading, screaming for him to wake up. As I found out later, she would often climb up on his bed, get right in his face, and yell for him to wake up. Trust me, I could hear her beside me. The poor woman was simply trying to be there for her husband and will him awake at all costs. When I think back to being in a coma, it's hard not to think of Marilyn and her desperate screams. I also think about the various sounds of people's voices, conversations, and the general buzz of the ICU. This may sound weird, but after spending so much time in the hospital, there's a soothing feeling I get when I hear the activity of a busy hospital. When the only thing you can do is listen, you end up hearing the symphony of life that you overlook in daily life. There's an entirely different world of sounds going on around us at all times that's really quite beautiful. It's fascinating to me how sounds can give you a visual imagery from a completely different place of experience. I couldn't see in a coma. Everything was black, pitch black, but I could experience. I experienced sounds, and those sounds produced a certain reality that was very much like seeing in the dark. It wasn't exactly like wearing night vision glasses, but it was similar. That's how I could tell I was in a room, because the sounds I heard were contained within an enclosed space. There's an environmental sound you hear in an enclosed space, which is different than the environment of an open space. It's interesting because your brain actually provides a field of vision just from sounds alone. I had no concept of time. There were no beginnings or endings of a day, or an hour, or a minute. It was all one state with waves of awareness, unconscious awareness. By the third day I was in a coma, doctors told my family that my condition had improved, but they couldn't say if I would ever wake up. The percentages of waking up did improve to about 30 to 40% that I'd come out of a coma, but chances were still 60 to 70% that I wouldn't. And the prognosis remained the same, that if I did wake up, I'd have severe brain damage and need assistance for the rest of my life. Things weren't looking good. At the same time, on the third day, something else was happening outside in the physical world beyond the hospital. Something enormously important and profound to this story. Like I mentioned in part one of this series, the previous episode, I was the victim of a hit-and-run accident. The driver fled the scene that night, leaving me clinging to life on the side of the road. Amid the terrifying chaos of the incident, one of the friends who was with me that night watched the car speed off down the highway into the night. He was a car enthusiast as a hobby, a car guy who loved cars. His eyes were fixed on the red taillights as the car disappeared into the darkness. When asked by police if he could identify the car, he told them he believed they belonged to a Mercury Capri. He wasn't 100% certain, but he stressed, that's the type of car the police should be searching for. On the third day of my coma, 3 days after my accident, the driver of the vehicle turned himself into police. It came out of nowhere. Everyone was surprised. I'll get into further details about this in a future episode, but what transpired next was truly amazing to me. When the police went to look at his car to match up the vehicle with what would have been certain damage from my body making impact with the car, they discovered evidence. From what I was told, there was damage to the front right side of the vehicle. The windshield was cracked from the impact of my head, with strands of my hair still stuck in the glass. More remarkable, however, the car was indeed a Mercury Capri. My friend had been right all along. Amid the instantaneous terror and panic of that night, how fast the accident happened, my friend was able to correctly identify the car in the dark just from the taillights alone. To this day, I'm still amazed how he was able to do that. If you listen to part one in which I elaborate on the Mercury Capri, one of the only things that distinguish a Mercury Capri from a Ford Mustang is the taillights. Although time wasn't an important factor for me in a coma, my family was forced to wait. I can't imagine how tough that must have been. Minutes for them must have seemed like hours. Rather than give in to time and that obvious feeling of helplessness, my family decided to try something new on the advice of a forward-thinking doctor who, after reading and learning about patients in a coma, suggested they play music to stimulate my brain in an effort to prompt some type of response. They were desperate to try anything, anything at all, so they agreed. The year was 1985. Only 6 years earlier, in 1979, Sony released the very first Walkman into the mainstream landscape. It was the first personal stereo tape deck. Between 1979 and 1985, music consumers saw the shift away from vinyl albums to cassette tapes. The Sony Walkman was a big deal. The first year it was introduced, the Walkman sold over 200 million units. It allowed everyone to be mobile with their music, on the go, with your favorite albums. You'd pop in your favorite cassette, put on your headphones, and off you went. Unlike phones or iPods, the big drawback was they were still fairly big, bulky, and you also had to carry your cassettes around with you. Back then, though, it didn't matter. You could take your music with you everywhere. As I laid there in a coma, in the hospital, within my own peaceful yet alternate reality, my family brought in my Sony Walkman that I purchased a year earlier. It was a Sony WM-F1 stereo radio Walkman, silver, very cool and state-of-the-art at the time. It had great sound for 1985. At the time, in 1985, Michael Jackson dominated the music scene. The now-famous Thriller video had debuted at Christmas in 1983 on the popular Friday Night Video Show. It was groundbreaking. I still remember where I was when I first saw the video, at my girlfriend's house, my first serious girlfriend. That video was a big deal for people growing up in the 80s. On the suggestion of the doctor, my family members would visit, put headphones on my ears, and play Michael Jackson albums on my Walkman in the hope that I could hear the music, in the hope that somehow I'd respond and react, show signs of life, anything. The fourth day of being in a coma passed, with the Walkman playing music in my ears. But I hadn't responded. My family members took turns talking to me, urging me to wake up, and playing music. Nothing seemed to work. What seemed like hope and promise on the first day of playing music in my ears turned to more hopelessness, deflation, and frustration by the end of the night. After further consultation with the doctors, in the morning on the fifth day, my family tried another tactic. When playing music in my ears, they turned their communication into a game of sorts. My father or my sister, for example, would play a song and then ask me if I could hear the music. They'd say to me, "Reggie, if you can hear the music, blink once for yes and twice for no." They'd grab my hand, play a song, and then say, "Reggie, if you can hear the music, squeeze my hand." They were once again hopeful, but, like the previous day, I wasn't responding. Now, I have to say, I do remember experiencing the music in a coma. It wasn't so much music, but rather an entire experience. A feeling of comfort and familiarity. A comforting, familiar link to the outside world. The music I remember feeling, and hearing, per se, was like a bridge between my world in a coma and the physical waking world. Like my unconscious awareness, however, that came in waves. That bridge would also come in waves. It was a bridge that I could follow rather than simply observing or being an observer of the sounds. And by follow, I mean more of a force that pulled me forward towards something, the music, something familiar with each wave of awareness and music. Around this time, there were two deeply fascinating events that happened to me. I'm not going to psychoanalyze them here in this episode. I'm simply going to lay the events out and let you take away whatever you take away. They happened to me, they're very real, and no one can take them away from me. In one wave of unconscious awareness, awake within my state of unconsciousness, I was able to see in the dark. Everything was still pitch black, but I could see. There weren't colors, only shades of gray, much like seeing in black and white. But I could see like I can see right now. My field of vision and my perspective was from one corner of the room, high above, in the far corner. And I was looking down at my bed, looking down at myself in the bed. I could see the night table beside the bed, a chair just to the right of the night table in the corner. There was a window on the wall on the right side of the room, but it was dark. No light was shining through. The only sounds I could hear were my internal thoughts, my curiosity of what I was looking at below. I wasn't afraid at all. In fact, the opposite. I remember being fully aware that I was looking down at myself, but I was more fascinated by the fact that I could see in the dark. I could finally see the room I was in and put some type of identification to the sounds I had been hearing from a place of surrounding environment. I knew that I wasn't home, but I was okay with that. I was content in the moment. I simply felt an overwhelming curiosity about what I was looking at in the room. A good curiosity. I don't know how long this lasted, but I remember the experience like it happened yesterday. It's never left me. This memory is also part of my waking experience today. I can put myself in that moment at any time. It's comforting and calming. It centers me. When things get tough or challenging in today's world, I lean into this memory where there is no fear or anxiety. All that matters is the moment. This memory to this day lets me know that, despite how tough things may be, everything will be okay. It always has been and always will be. The second profound event happened around the same time. It involved the father of John Hugh, the man I previously mentioned who was in a coma in the same room beside me, and his wife was pleading for him to wake up. John Hugh's father was visiting his son in the same room. He was a veteran of World War II who had fought in Europe and brought back a vial of holy water from the Vatican after the war. He brought the vial into the hospital to bless his son, John Hugh, and sprinkle holy water on his body in the hope that something good would happen. After blessing his son with holy water, John Hugh's father offered to bless me and do the same in the hope that something good would happen to me as well. I do remember this moment, but only from an auditory place. I remember hearing prayers and the action of motion, which would have been the act of sprinkling the holy water. I don't know when it was, and it wasn't quite as vivid as my previous experience of seeing myself in the room from high above in the corner. This was more subtle, but equally as comforting. Over the next couple of days, my family members continued playing music in my ears and asking me questions. My father switched strategies from asking me to blink and squeeze his hand to asking me to move my toes. "Reggie," he said in desperation, "if you can hear the music, if you can hear me, wiggle your big toe. Please, if you can hear me at all, wiggle your toe." And then it happened. I wiggled my toe. Something good just happened. I was responding. I was communicating. It was an epic, amazing event to my family, the nurses, and doctors. Everyone was suddenly in tears. Tears of joy. Still, though, I wasn't awake. I was still in a coma. My father asked me again, "Reggie, if you can hear me, wiggle your toe." I did it again. At one point, my family put the headphones back on my head and turned on my Walkman. I began to move my toe to the music. As I later found out, the doctors didn't really know what to make of my progress. They were cautiously optimistic. Obviously, the percentages of my prognosis had changed for the better. Still, the doctors couldn't say for certain what the progress meant for my future. I could respond to stimuli and respond to questions, but I still wasn't awake. Again, all that anyone could do was wait and see. Over the next 24 hours, I was able to move more toes when asked. I was also able to squeeze my father's hand when asked a question. Things were looking good, but chances were that if I woke up, I'd still suffer some degree of brain damage. Like I mentioned in the previous episode, at the time of my accident, I was a big sports guy. I played hockey, baseball, football, basketball, ran track and cross country. My life revolved around sports year-round. Just over a month earlier, in April of 1985, I remember being glued to the TV watching the NCAA college basketball finals in which Villanova Wildcats upset Patrick Ewing and the mighty Georgetown Hoyas. It was one of the greatest upsets in college basketball history. When I first arrived at the hospital, after my initial surgery, doctors told my parents that because I was young, played so many sports, and was in such good physical shape, my body was better prepared to handle some of the trauma. There was good reason for hope from a physical standpoint, but the brain is fragile and complex. I might have been physically fine body-wise, but there was a high degree of uncertainty because of my head injury. Although I was responding and able to communicate somewhat with the outside world, beyond my alternate reality of a coma, things could take a turn for the worse at any moment. Further progress beyond this wasn't guaranteed. Tomorrow, we could be back to square one with no answers. Traumatic brain injuries are complicated and unpredictable. In telling the story of my accident and my time in a coma these past two episodes, I'm even more aware today of the impact it had on others. I'm fascinated by how this one single event was seen and experienced by multiple people from multiple perspectives. I can't imagine what it must have been like for my family to watch me lying there motionless in the hospital, waiting for any signs of life or progress. Time must have slowed to a near stop. Seconds must have seemed like hours, minutes like days. I'm even more intrigued by the contrast of experiences of that same time, how my family experienced time in watching and waiting versus how time was irrelevant to me in my state of coma. Time was everything to them, while time wasn't a factor for me. I haven't really thought about that in all these years until now, telling you this story. There's an interesting contrast of extremes in two different experiences of time. And then, it was time. Everything was suddenly bright. It was like the sun was shining directly in my eyes from the ceiling. I blinked my eyes, tightly, open and shut, you know, when you suddenly wake up from a deep sleep and you're disoriented. The light above me was so bright, I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, will someone turn the lights out? That's way too bright. But I hadn't spoken a word. I looked ahead, forward, to see the room, the same room I had seen in a coma in black and white, only now everything was in color, bright color. I could see the window on the left-hand side of the wall. The curtains were open. It was a beautiful, sunny day. The room was quiet, very peaceful. I looked around the room, slowly, scanning the surroundings. An open door on the right, another bed in front of me, the window on the left, and then, further to the left, directly beside me in the corner, my father, crying, with tears streaming down his face. What the hell is he doing here? Why in the world is he crying? What happened? Where am I? And then she appeared, directly above me, obscuring the bright light on the ceiling. A woman with sandy brown hair, beautiful eyes, the color of hazel, all dressed in white. She was stunningly gorgeous, a knockout. The glow of light around her head made her look like an angel. Was she an angel? It was heavenly. I remember thinking to myself, wow, this is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. She was smiling at me, her eyes watering with joy, looking directly into my eyes. I felt an overwhelming sense of peace and comfort as she smiled. Reggie, she said in a soft but urgent tone, can I get you anything? Anything, anything at all. The last thing on my mind was wanting anything. I was too captivated by her beauty. But she persisted with the question. Reggie, can you hear me? Can I get you anything? Anything? At that moment, I remember thinking to myself, I don't need anything or want anything. But if I'm forced to think about it, what I need or what I want, well, sure, I can think of something. Reggie, she continued, anything, anything at all. Just tell me. I looked her directly in the eyes, thought about it for a second, because I had to. She was waiting for an answer. And I said the first thing that came to mind. Sure, there is something you can get me. A blowjob would be nice. Those were the very first words out of my mouth when I woke up from a coma. The nurse, looking down at me, burst into hysterical laughter. My father jumped up from his seat, crying and laughing at the same time. They were both laughing together. I was just looking at the two of them. I remember watching my father as he ran out of the room, shouting to my family in the hallway, he's definitely all better now. He's back. That's the day I woke up from a week-long coma. That's also the day my entire life started over from a clean slate. It was the most profound turning point in my life. I was forced to let go of everything I knew. I was about to enter a 5-year period of recovery, which included several life-saving surgeries, major brain surgery, eye surgery, knee surgeries, and so many more. Within the aftermath of my accident, there were many points of starting over. Stay tuned for the next episode of Starting Overdrive Turning Points called My 5-Year Recovery Period, in which I detail more of the aftermath of my accident, the lifelong injuries I suffered, nearly losing my life, undergoing major brain surgery, letting go of the life I knew, starting over, and losing my family. Also in the next episode, I detail letting go of my identity, my fight to finish school while being in and out of the hospital, and how I was suddenly different in the blink of an eye than everyone I knew. Thanks for listening to the Starting Over Drive podcast. Join us next time for another real story of starting over. In the meantime, make sure to follow us on Spotify, YouTube, Amazon, Stitcher, and all major podcasting platforms. Head to the Starting Over Drive Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, subscribe to our channels, help us grow, and feel free to share your story of starting over, or even let us know if you relate to any of the issues touched upon in our interviews. You can also find us at the Starting Overdrive podcast at the official site, www.startingoverdrive.com.